KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Human trafficking, which is a modern form of slavery, is not only about people being trafficked into our country, but about people being trafficked within our country.
This is another step forward in the long journey to rebuild our economy here in Washington and to help homeowners and families recover from the mortgage crisis that has battered our state and our nation.
You know, growing up, for me, it was always Dennis Miller, Norm Macdonald, and then I got to see people like Jimmy and Tina and Amy do it, and the lessons I've learned from all of them are immense.
Seth Meyers, Saturday Night Live Weekend Update anchor. We're going to talk to him about his work. And Rob McKenna, Attorney General, talking about some of the things he's accomplished. He joins us to talk about that work. Rob McKenna was Attorney General for two terms in Washington State. Before then, King County Council member. He ran for governor this past time. Good to see you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
By the way, you're supposed to grow a beard after you...
the Greg Nichols model. Yeah, yeah. It always makes me itch. I don't know how you do it, Steve.
It makes me itch.
For those of you who haven't seen a picture of Steve, he's got a great beard, but it always makes my skin itch.
So. I just figured you'd come in with a beard. That did not happen.
It did not.
All right. I wanted to start with the AG stuff.
Yeah.
And then talk after the break. We'll talk about politics.
Sure.
But so let's focus on AG. Two terms. What stands out for you is you're going to walk away and say, this is really something we accomplished that we know will be a lasting legacy in this state.
Well, I'm really proud of the fact that my staff and I personally led the negotiations in all of the big settlements with the banks and mortgage originators, starting with Ameriquest in 2005 and 2006, which we settled with two AGs, myself and Tom Miller of Iowa, working together. Then four of us negotiated the countrywide settlement with Bank of America, and then six of us negotiated the $25 billion settlement. And it isn't just about the money. It isn't just about $650 million coming back to our state as a result of that last settlement. Hundreds of millions.
That settlement is a settlement on the – which is the last settlement you're talking
about?
The last
one is the $25 billion settlement with the five biggest loan servicers in the country. So we're talking Bank of America, Citi, Chase. And we've been monitoring its implementation very carefully, and hundreds of millions has already flowed back to people in terms of loan modifications and principal forgiveness and restructuring their loans or just refinancing. But the most important thing about that settlement is that we negotiated extensive new rules for loan servicing. In other words, new standards that the banks and other mortgage servicers now have to follow when they're dealing with someone's home mortgage and servicing it, or when they're dealing with them on a loan modification or even on a foreclosure. We found a lot of abuse of people in the foreclosure process and in the loan modification process, so we wrote very clear rules, very detailed rules, and we put a monitor in place who's monitoring the compliance of the banks with those new rules, and the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is led by former Attorney General Richard Cordray, is now monitoring compliance as well. So I'm really proud of that. You know, those changes that now provide more protection to homeowners.
Who does the monitor in this state work under?
The monitor is a national monitor who reports to the Attorney General's office in our state, as he does to the other states. And there have always been a small group of us nationally who have focused particularly intensively on this issue. And so our executive committee continues to monitor it. You know, I served on the Department of Justice's Financial Fraud Task Force and chaired its mortgage subcommittee. That helped improve relationships with federal monitoring and federal enforcement. And it was a very gratifying 8 years working on those issues.
You know, we talked to somebody just earlier this week who's a fraud investigator and also hired to do appraisals and looks at fraud in appraisals.
Yeah.
Says he still sees abuses going on, still sees individuals in different banks flouting the rules. How do you push back on that?
Well, there's more monitoring now, more likelihood of an audit, and also because in the consumer protection business, attorneys general rely heavily on consumer tips, consumer complaints. When someone feels that they're seeing that, they can report it, and we have the mechanism in place to go after it and investigate it.
Let's talk about the money coming back though, because borrowers who were illegally foreclosed on in the state, they'll get about $2,000 a piece at an average. you know, a lot of people said that wasn't adequate, and that the big banks in the end got off the hook, and that you guys were too easy on them.
Well, you know, the Obama administration and 50 states would disagree with that. We achieved a record settlement that not only brought back a huge amount of money, but also changed the regulatory framework for loan servicing dramatically. And we were able to accomplish all of that within less than 2 years. If we had litigated, which was the alternative to reaching the structured settlement, we would still be in court. We'd be in court for several years more. And the homeowners in our state who have been able to stay in their homes and receive hundreds of millions in relief would probably be out of their homes in many cases.
There's a difference between criminal and civil action as well. But why didn't people go to jail for this?
Because the standard for criminal fraud is very high. And it wasn't met in these cases involving foreclosure practices and loan servicing practices. Just that simple. If you know, the feds and the states looked at the behavior and analyzed it under civil law and criminal law, and the way our criminal laws are written, it simply didn't meet that standard.
You know, you look at all the AGs that got involved in this over the country and the Obama administration. When people look back on the programs that were put in place to initially help people, they quickly shifted from trying to get relief to individual homeowners to try to take on the larger issue, the TARP, and the other issues where the money was shifted. This is more of a political question, but what happened to what did happen to the person who was duped into doing bad loans or ended up in a loan they shouldn't have gotten into, but were enticed or greedy enough to go into those loans? What happened to those people?
Some of those people received cash awards if they did actually lose their home. Not enough to fully compensate them, but then these are organizations like AmeriQuest that went out of business, so there was a limited amount of money to access. And these problems resulted in a much stricter regulations and requirements for the lenders and for the loan servicers that didn't exist before. And now you have more enforcement mechanisms, not only at the state level, but also with the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is monitoring all kinds of loans, not just home loans, but now is auditing loans by auto dealers and other kinds of lenders as well.
Do you think that federal response was the only response that could have really clamped down on this industry? As AG of one state, were you somewhat powerless?
No, not powerless. We have the Consumer Protection Act in our state, and the other states have them as well, and you can go after unfair and deceptive practices. But what we needed and what we now have is a common set of standards for the whole country that can be enforced by the states, but also is enforced and monitored by the federal government. You know, with respect to banking, the states are preempted by federal law in many instances, and so that has been a limitation on us. And it is better now to have a high degree of coordination between the states and the federal government, and both sides having enforcement power, which we previously lacked. In 2006, for example, when Attorney General Tom Miller and I approached the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the nation's commercial banking regulator, they didn't even want to talk to us about AmeriQuest or Countrywide because they said, well, these guys aren't banks. They're non-bank mortgage originators. And it was very, very frustrating. But in 2009, we had a big meeting at the Department of Justice. And ever since then, we've had a very high level of coordination.
Going forward, what are your concerns about too big to fail?
I think that this is a real continuing problem for America, that we are creating what is called a moral hazard, where large financial institutions may feel that if they get out over their skis, you know, they're essentially insured by the taxpayers. And I do think it's a legitimate concern. At the same time, I know small banks are being squeezed very, very tightly now, and they don't get bailed out. They get shut down. So I worry about a double standard for America's largest banks and financial institutions. At the same time, we have a level of scrutiny now and a level of oversight and enforcement that is tougher and didn't exist several years ago.
Do we need more charges to those big banks so they can be paying into the fund as an insurance policy?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to look at.
I mean, they have that somewhat, right? We have some of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They all pay into the FDIC. Yeah. That's how that.
But it's not adequate for the too big to fail
part. And remember that where the big banks got into real trouble was not. was often involved their investment banking activities. When the wall was broken down between commercial banking and investment banking, you started to see them taking the same kind of risk that investment banks like Goldman Sachs were taking. So I think that ought to be revisited.
Rob McKenna was Attorney General of Washington State for two terms. One of the things you worked on early on, and we talked about, was gang activity and gangs, especially in eastern Washington. Had a hard time getting the legislature to push through the bills you wanted them to push through. What needs to be done now?
Well, we need to continue to focus on giving kids alternatives to the gang lifestyle. So, the fact that there are only a handful of Boys and Girls Clubs in all of eastern Washington is an example of not giving kids enough activities, not only in small rural communities like Royal City or Wapato, but in bigger cities like Yakima. And so that's a key part. You have to give kids attractive, healthy alternatives. Number two, we have to crack down on the gang leaders. We saw a big upsurge in gang activity when a number of these guys were let out of prison after being convicted originally. They went right back to their old behaviors, their old activities, recruiting younger and younger children. So you have to tackle the problem on both ends of the spectrum, the old leaders who are called shot callers for the gangs, and then helping the kids avoid going into that lifestyle to begin with.
What tools are needed by the AG's office to do that?
Well, we and all prosecutors in the state would like to have tougher additional sanctions for gang leaders. In other words, stronger enhancements to their sentences so we can keep them off the streets longer.
Oh, I see. Keep them in prison longer.
Yeah, because we know that works. And as they get older, they do tend to finally stop the gang activity. They age out is how we refer to it. But again, everyone in law enforcement will tell you that we can't solve this with cops or with prosecutors. We've got to help parents with alternatives for their kids. When you got two parents are working hard and getting home late, or even just one parent, that calls out for example, keeping the schools open later and inviting nonprofit groups like the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Club and other groups into the schools. Keep the kids at school till 5 or 6 and give them tutoring and arts and athletics. But don't send them home at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, because that period of time until dinner time is often when a lot of the trouble occurs.
We're going to come back to that at the end of this segment. You worked on meth lab reduction, you worked on sex trafficking, you worked on identity theft.
Yep.
And you felt you had successes in that.
Yep.
So what does Bob Ferguson have to keep in place, or what will you be watching for, to see that he keeps the pressure on those issues?
Well, with meth, we now have laws in place that make it harder for people to start a meth lab in their home or in their car or anywhere else, because it's harder to get the precursor drugs, the pseudoephedrine and ephedrine that you need to cook up meth. And that's why we have dramatic reduction in the number of meth labs compared to the year before I became AG. That year in 2004, there were about 1,400 meth lab incidents. Last year, there were fewer than 50 statewide. So we've clearly made progress. It doesn't mean meth has disappeared. The drug cartels still traffic it in, and that means we need to continue to focus on drug treatment as well as going after the cartels. But we don't see the number of children being poisoned by meth labs. We don't see the number of fires and burns. That's good. So what Bob needs to do is to continue to support those laws which are in place right now, which can create inconvenience. You have to sign for your pseudoephedrine. You have to, be limited in the amount you can buy. But it works. Those limitations are clearly having the effect that we wanted. On identity theft, the work is never done. Number one, because the bad guys are very creative. They're even ingenious in terms of new ways to scam people, to trick them out of their personal information. But on the other hand, we've given consumers new tools they didn't have before. We, for example, introduced a bill to the legislature that they passed, which allows any consumer in the state the power to freeze their credit history. So if you think you might be at risk of identity theft, you can go online to the credit rating agencies like Equifax, and you can put a freeze on your credit history. You don't have to already be a victim of identity theft, which was the old rule. You can just do it because you want to. And that will prevent anybody from accessing your credit history to open a line of credit in your name. We didn't have that ability before, and we had to fight the credit rating agencies to get that law through, but we did pass it. And it's one of the reasons that Washington has been steadily dropping in the national rankings for identity theft instances.
And sex trafficking?
Well, this is an issue that wasn't on the radar screen at all, except by a handful of very brave and visionary nonprofit leaders and religious. It was the nuns in our city who started working on this problem about 15 years ago and really began to network nationally through the sisters. And when I started working on it, there were still just a few people focused on it. But now, since I made it the number one priority of the National Association of Attorneys General in my year as president, there is a standing committee at our national association working on this problem year round. There's a much higher profile. The American Bar Association president has made it her top priority for the year. So we now have a higher focus on it, a higher level of awareness, and for all of that, we have a long way to go because awareness then needs to result in action. That means we need to support programs that give shelter to victims of human trafficking. And it means we need to recognize that the street gangs and organized crime are moving more and more into human trafficking. So that means we have to tackle it from the law enforcement side as well.
You know, your office had to start thinking about legal marijuana. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Bob Ferguson's going to have to think about that now. I have one question about that.
Sure.
Some of the people who have been illegal pot growers testified before these two hearings, the liquor board, saying, you should let us be a part of this because we understand the industry and we want to be legitimate and we would like to be licensed, even though we have on our records, some of them, convictions for being pot growers.
Right.
Given that we're entering into new territory, what do you think about that argument?
Well, I think that the law would have to be changed further because the initiative the voters approve simply decriminalizes or legalizes the possession of an ounce or less of marijuana by a consumer, doesn't legalize the growing of marijuana. So the legislature would have to consider that policy and recognize that it will, like the basic law that just passed the voters, will run right into federal prohibitions.
But doesn't the law, it sets up some system of regulating the distribution of legally grown marijuana?
There is a system, and I don't know how that's going to work out ultimately. So it may be that we can set up a legalized growing system that's regulated and licensed, but it could also be that some of that will require additional law.
Glad you're not going to be in office for that one?
That's a tough one for everyone who in state government. We worry, as Governor Gregoire pointed out last year or the year before, we worry about state employees being liable for federal law violations that may relate to them just trying to implement the law. So it's a tough place to be. It's a tough thing for one state to do given the supremacy of federal law under our Constitution.
Rob McKenna is our guest. We'll take a break, come back, and talk politics on Weekday.
46 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says clouds, chance of showers through the day. Clouds, chance of showers overnight. Same thing tomorrow. In fact, it looks like showers all the way through the next week or so. Join KUOW for the Future of Flight Foundation's Family STEM Night, with local companies and organizations offering hands-on activities featuring STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math topics. February 6th at the Future of Flight Aviation Center in Mukilteo. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org. It's 9:23. I'm Bernard Bollett. A conversation with actor and comedian Seth Meyers from Saturday Night Live in 20 minutes.
Rob McKenna is our guest, the former attorney general, done after two terms, ran for governor of the state. All right, I have a question for you, and here's something we observed. During Governor Gregoire's farewell speech, she talked about health care reform.
Yeah.
And following a reference to President Obama's health care overhaul, you, like everybody else, stood and applauded. Did that signal a change in your thinking about health care reform?
Well, what I heard her talking about was the importance of access to health care. She didn't reference the healthcare law and the healthcare lawsuit particularly, she just said, look, it's important for people to have access to healthcare. And I think that's an area of common agreement. The question is, you know, how do you do it? That's why I stood. I think that we have to stand up for healthcare access and healthcare reform. We have to do it in a way that respects the Constitution and individual liberty. But I've always thought that creating more access to healthcare for people is a better alternative than people having to go to the ER for everything they need.
Okay. So maybe it didn't signal a change in your views on the law itself.
I think that the reporter who blogged about that might have been reading a little bit too much into what we were doing with our clapping and our standing and sitting.
All right. So again, a political question, not because you and I have talked at length about the legal argument about the healthcare law.
Yeah.
In retrospect, and I know it's 2020, did you make the wrong political calculation in signing on to the lawsuit?
I didn't make a political calculation. It was moving too fast, and I had to decide what I thought was right under the law. And this is a law that even today does not enjoy majority support in the state as it's currently written. A majority of people would like to see changes to it. So, in retrospect, I don't think...
Did it hurt you?
Well, it's really hard to say. It's interesting that the results that I saw in the election were not that different. In fact, were better than other Republicans for whom that wasn't an issue. They weren't involved in the healthcare laws, other statewide candidates. So I think for some people it was a reason to vote the way they did. But if you look at the results in the election, you look at the fact that, Kim Wyman and I basically got the same number of votes in the 7th Congressional District in Seattle. Well, obviously, health care wasn't an issue for her, neither were the other issues. And yet she still didn't do any better than I did. So I think what we saw in the election more than anything was a polarization of positions, a hardening of positions on both sides. And there were obviously a fair number of people who refused to vote for the other side just because of the party. They just wouldn't do it. And that's what it came down to.
You know, I remember among the various ads, I remember the ad where you were in front of a Tea Party rally. Mm-hmm. And I think the quote was, "You people are awesome." Do you remember that ad?
Oh, yeah.
I think the Inslee campaign run that ad, or was that run by a third party group? Did that hurt you? Do you know? Did you guys do an assessment on that, whether that particular association with Tea Party in Washington State hurt you?
I think it reinforced with hardcore Democrats, it reinforced their hostility to groups like the Tea Party groups. But the fact is, it was not a Tea Party rally. It was a rally organized by a number of different organizations.
Well, whatever the truth was, how it was portrayed.
How it was portrayed was a distortion, like so many of the ads were, and was actually false. And what I was expressing was amazement that over 2,000 people would show up on the steps of the Capitol on a weekend to talk about their concerns with the individual health insurance mandate and other aspects of that law. So that's what I was referring to. And of course, it was spun for political purposes. I mean, look, Steve, long before the healthcare lawsuit, before this was a big issue, the Democrats were already attacking me. They decided they would attack early and often. They launched their first website attacking me in February of 2010, more than a year before I announced for governor. And their theme all throughout was, Rob McKenna isn't who he says he is. Well, that's baloney. Ask anyone who actually knows me and they'll tell you I'm exactly who I say I am. And they knew they had to change that. So they had to convince people of their own narrative, their own falsehood, which is I'm not who I say I am.
Why does that work? And
why does it work? Because it allows them to—
I assume you're saying it worked.
It worked with some people, and it probably had an effect on the outcome of the election. It worked because they were playing off of the increasing tribalization of politics in our country, where you can't vote for someone because he's of a certain political party. We're going to demonize your choice to vote. I mean, if you look at the research by my campaign or by independent pollsters, my ratio of favorable to unfavorable in those polls, which is a standard question, do you view this candidate favorably or unfavorably, was very, very good. And there were clearly people saying, yeah, I like him, I view him favorably, but I can't vote for him because he's a Republican. And that's exactly what those ads that you referred to and what the website attacking me set up by the state Democratic Party was aiming at. They decided that they had to be negative and go on the attack long before I even announced for governor, and that's exactly what they did. And the ad that you referred to is just part of that overall narrative.
course, you guys didn't come in unarmed. You had your own weapons. You threw your own ads. I mean, this this is the reality of our politics today.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. But we started our campaign focused on policies and ideas, focusing on education funding, education reform, on fiscal stability and reforming state government, and we ran an honorable campaign that stayed very focused on the issues of the day, and of course went after my opponent for his record in Congress, but all of that was in fact factual.
Do you really see a substantial difference in the way the Democrats or the third party programs on his side and you guys approached?
Oh, absolutely. Again, we didn't set up a website attacking Jay Inslee months ahead of his announcement. We also never accused him of not being who he said he was. We said he's exactly who he is, which is all we needed to do, in our opinion.
You're cutting it with a fine tooth fine knife there.
Well, no, look, what they did was a steady stream of distortions and innuendo and so forth. And what we did was look at Jay Inslee's congressional record. If you like his voting record, then vote for him. And he never wanted to talk about that. He rarely talked about the fact that he was a congressman during the campaign, because he didn't want to run on being from Congress, and he wanted to run away from Congress. And we, of course, were bringing people's attention back to the fact that he did have a record he needed to explain.
What are you going to look for in Jay Inslee as governor? What are you watching out for?
I mean, like all voters, I'll be watching to see if he keeps his promises.
Is keeping a tax in place raising taxes?
Yeah, I think that a tax that's going to expire, that's unrenewed, is raising a tax above what it would be.
What if you do it before the date that's being renewed? All the people in Congress said they didn't vote for a tax increase.
Well, these were taxes that were voted in on the premise they would be temporary. They were voted in at the worst point of the economic recession. So we just need this temporary
in Washington State. But that's what they said about the Bush tax cuts. They were temporary.
But you asked me about Jay's position on these state taxes that are about to expire and whether renewing them is a tax increase violating his promise. I mean, I think it clearly is a violation of his campaign promise. He is trying to have it both ways. And it's just the beginning of a series of what could be backtracking moves away from the campaign promises that he made.
What do you think of Randy Tom's idea to and other Republicans too, that GET is a drain on the state higher education system and the guaranteed education tuition program should be eliminated?
Well, Senator Tom knows the finances better than I do. I haven't looked at the spreadsheet for that program. It's clearly become a lot more expensive than was envisioned, because they've been cutting higher education funding over the years and making up for it with massive tuition increases, which makes the GET program that much more expensive. I think that GET could be saved if they would stabilize and then improve state funding for higher education, so that you don't see big tuition increases in the future. You know, keep tuition at its current level or lower if you can. Stop raising tuition and shifting the burden to families and students, and GET probably would be more solvent.
You have said that you want to stay involved in education. You're talking pre-K through college, I imagine.
Yeah.
So now that you're not governor, do you have an idea of where that money for higher ed would come from?
Well, first of all, you fund K-12 first. You don't say, oh, we can't fund it until we have more taxes. The voters have clearly said that's not interesting to them. They don't want that approach. Fund education first, which means you'll have less money for non-public education purposes. And then on higher education, do what I suggested in the campaign, which is take growth in the state budget and revenues that are projected to go up by over $10 billion in the next decade, and devote a large part of that both to K-12 and higher ed.
But I hear them saying they can devote it to K-12 but not to higher ed.
Well, they always have to have a hostage to take.
Well, it seems like higher ed is
increases. Well, they've been doing that for years.
Well, I'm saying on the Republican side, too. They're saying higher ed can't – there's no money for higher ed at this point.
To this biennium, that's probably true. Beyond this biennium, not true. Just take a look at the projections that we made and the financial model we created that leverages growth in the state budgets, growth in state revenues over the next 8 to 10 years, and it is possible.
You know, there was a new poll came out we were just talking about. Why hasn't Washington elected a Republican governor in over 30 years? This is more information. They asked some people. This is not a huge poll, not a lot of people, but 31% said too focused on conservative social issues, 29% said don't know, and 40% said too often puts forward policies helping big business and the rich. Mm-hmm. Republicans are involved right now in a look at what happened and what happened with their brand or with their party. Bobby Jindal has been tweeting about it. I saw one that somebody said, you know, it's not only what we say, but it's how we say it. That sure. was one of the Republicans.
Yeah, Frank Luntz talked about the use of language, the importance of language.
Well, of course, Frank Luntz has always talked about the use of language. Republicans are very successful in the use of language for many years. Where do you see the party's shift going forward, if a shift is needed?
Well, I think that Bobby Jindal is right that you can't just approach everything with a green eye shade. It isn't just about fiscal issues, as important as those are. That's why in my campaign for governor, I led with public school funding and public school reform, because I think people care about their kids more than anything else. So I think that Republicans have to broaden the issue set to touch more issues that are of concern to a wider number of voters.
But like what?
Well, education, again.
Okay.
The fact that our public school system is underperforming and is underfunded is a key example. Higher ed is another example. At the federal level, immigration is clearly a crucial issue. People who are not even themselves immigrants but are the parent or the children or grandchildren of immigrants view the failure to move forward on immigration reform as being anti-immigrant. And every time anyone talks about deporting large numbers of people, they view it as being anti-immigrant, not anti-illegal immigrant per se. So addressing immigration reform, as Marco Rubio is attempting to do, is an example of broadening the message and inviting people back into the party.
I mean, the Republicans have focused on issues other than the economy. They focused on social issues. And some of those social issues have been the bread and butter of the core of the party, including for example, gay issues and marriage issues, and we know that you and your wife apparently have somewhat different ideas about that. Does the Republican Party need to get out of people's bedrooms, as she was quoted as?
Yeah, I think in our state that's right. I think that we're more libertarian as Republicans. Not that there aren't a number of Republicans in the state and some Democrats as well who've cared very deeply about that issue set, and I respect the fact they care deeply about it. But we take a more libertarian approach to such issues in our state, and a strong focus on those issues. And
but do you bring that to the party? Do you bring that to the national party, that idea?
Well, what
you personally, I mean.
Yeah, I do. You can't be successful in a state like Washington or Oregon or other similar states with a message that is what you're running in, you know, a deep red state in the South. I think that's a message that's being delivered right now as the Republican National Committee is meeting. And it's a message that I'll deliver to the RNC when they come out here for a post-election discussion in the next several weeks. It's exactly what they need to hear. The parties are coalitions. There has to be room for lots of viewpoints, including viewpoints that are libertarian, that are moderate on the social issues, and you can't operate out of the same bolt of cloth across the country and expect to win. What works in a deep red state is not going to work in an Oregon, Washington, or apparently even in states like Montana.
Think we're in a new Confederacy here? The Republican Party is the South of the old Confederacy.
There is a risk of the Republican Party becoming just a regional party, and that's why Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, has said in his speech that in the last couple of days that the Republican Party cannot keep focusing on so-called battleground states. Because what they're doing is they're effectively fighting on a shrinking battlefield. They're giving up on so many states. I mean, one of the reasons that I didn't win my election is that this is the first time since at least 1978 that there was no Republican TV spending in Washington in any of the federal races. There was no spending in the presidential race. There was no spending in the Senate race. They just wrote the state off from the very beginning. They did that in other states as well. And so the Democrats, for the third or fourth election in a row for president, basically started with the same 18 states in their camp. And they started with something like 238 electoral votes out of 270, and they just had to pick up the balance of that. That's a losing strategy. And therefore, the message has to be broadened and the tolerance for a diversity of viewpoints has to be broadened in our party so that you're not just trying to sell the party in a state that's already deep red.
got to change your platform at the conventions then, too.
Yeah, I think you do. That's right. They need to be, there needs to be more tolerance for the libertarian approach to these issues.
Not the liberal approach, though. You said, I noticed you said moderacy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people who are to way to the left are going to stay with the Democrats. That's understood.
All right. Maybe you'll come back and talk to us again as a private citizen.
As an outraged voter.
And doggone it.
And so he's been calling and filing complaints. Absolutely.
Good.
It'll be fun. And I'm going to keep working on education reform. I'm going to keep working on human trafficking. So we'll always have plenty to talk about, Steve. Thanks for all the opportunities over the last 8 years, though. I've really enjoyed our conversations.
I have, too. I look forward to having you coming on as Rob McKenna, outraged voter.
Thanks.
This is Weekday.
Seth Meyers from Saturday Night Live is our guest in a minute. It's 9:39, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Despite the horrors of the Holocaust, many concentration camp prisoners managed to compose music on scraps of paper. A music scholar has collected and published thousands of these works.
They wanted to leave a testament. They leave to us music.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Whitefish Mountain Resort, celebrating 65 years of skiing and snowboarding on 3,000 acres of bowls, steeps, and glades in Whitefish, Montana. Direct flights and train service from Seattle daily. More information at skiwhitefish.com.
47 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast calls for a chance of showers. It's 9:40. Protests and violence today in Cairo on the anniversary of Egypt's revolution. We're following developments there, and we'll get an update in 20 minutes.
We'll turn to a little comedy first. Seth Meyers, the Saturday Night Live anchor, Weekend Update anchor, and head writer of the show, is going to be in town next Thursday, January 31st, at the Paramount. He also does stand-up. So we got to talk to him a little bit ago. I asked him about taking on the role of Weekend Update anchor. After many great comedians have held the job before him, I was wondering how he saw himself in that role.
Here's the thing about when you actually have to go out and perform comedy. Like, you can sort of think about your approach and whatnot during the week when you have some quiet time. But when you're actually out there performing, you know, you actually kind of have to get out of your head as far as, like, the importance of what you're doing and just try to be the best version of yourself telling jokes, which is, I feel like when I do a Weekend Update best, it's probably that, where you're just completely in the moment and completely focused on just telling the joke the best possible way.
In aviation news, the FAA is considering banning airline pilots from using personal mobile devices in the cockpit to prevent them from being distracted while flying. And in terrifying news, they haven't already done that.
As far as, like, the legacy of the show, it's impossible to ignore, you know, like, the hallway we all have our offices on. You know, we have the headshot of every person who was ever in the cast of the show. So it's actually, like, a very interesting thing because sort of for every movie star you walk by, you might walk by somebody that you kind of don't know what they're up to now, and it's a reminder that this show provides opportunity more than is, like, sort of a rubber stamp for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it does. It does provide opportunity, but
it does provide an incredible opportunity. But you know, for me, growing up, for me, it was always Dennis Miller was sort of the first anchor, and when I was watching the show, and then Norm Macdonald, and then obviously in the time I was a cast member here, I got to see people like Jimmy and Tina and Amy do it, and the lessons I've learned from all of them are immense.
Did you ever say, Jimmy, you can't laugh at this joke?
I would never. Because ideally it would be my joke, in which case I would, fire away.
The man could not get through a joke. He was brilliant at it.
He was really brilliant at it. Everybody, I think, and why he's so great at his show now is he is a person who is having a good time, which I think is really important in comedy.
You know, I was working at a comedy club as a bartender back in whatever decade that was, the 80s, and Dennis Miller was the headliner, and he sits down, and he's drinking, and he says, you know what, this is my last this is my last tour because I just got hired by Saturday Night Live. And he had this, and it was amazing. And he had this look in his eyes that was, you know, he had arrived. He was going to Mecca. And was that the feeling you had?
It was the best. If there was one day in my life I could relive one day in my life, it would be the day that I got the show, just because it was so much fun to sort of call people and tell them that. Because it's a show that means a lot to so many different people. It was really exciting.
Does that ever surprise you that after all these years, you know, you can watch on YouTube, on Netflix, you can watch every episode, you can see the evolution of the show. Does it ever surprise you that it still has this power in the system, in our system?
I don't know if it surprises me. I mean, I guess I'm more like grateful that it does. I mean, you know, the part of the show that I think is you know, sort of the key to its longevity is that it's constantly sort of refreshing its roster of talent. You know, people come here, you know, ideally they give the show sort of 7 great formative years. And then, you know, they leave here with a completely refined voice, and then they use that voice to continue to entertain people for years and years after that. But because of it, it's just the greatest place. You know, the show invites people who sort of are figuring out what their comic voice is to sort of work it out live on TV, and it's just a really exciting process. And the show, you know, gets to be this sort of like wild, wonderful, you know, uneven at times, you know, production that no one else is trying to do anymore, which is live television.
So you're much more than 7 years now. What are you, 12? Going into your
12. It's sort of now, I will say, it's reached the point where it sort of blends, it's blending together.
Well, do you stay because as head writer you have a big role in shaping the voices of the other comedians?
On my best week, I feel like I can help shape the voices. But the reality is, like, the people who succeed on this show are the most sort of, like, hardworking, self-creating people I've ever met. Like, it's more than anything, sort of, I'm just constantly inspired by the people who come through the door here. I mean, I think the main reason I'm still here, or I'd like to think I'm still here, is that I can't imagine my next job won't be boring compared to this one. And that's the part of this job that I love so much, is that I'm never, even for half a second, bored.
Seth Meyers is the head writer of NBC's Saturday Night Live. And in town, January 31st at the Paramount, to do stand-up. Do you do stand-up the way Seinfeld says he does stand-up, because that's where the real essence of comedy emerges?
I mean, I do stand-up mostly because I love stand-up. I love the rush of it. I love the sort of gladiatorial nature of being one person who has to entertain an entire audience. And also, you know, it's a way for me to sort of express my voice in a completely different way than I can on Saturday Night Live, you know. Whereas, you know, when I write here, I'm sort of thinking about, like, you know, what's in the news, what's in the culture, what are people talking about. In stand-up, it gives me a chance to both do that, but also sort of, you know, tell things through the spectrum of my own personal experiences in a way that would be indulgent if I did it on the show.
What describe some of your stand-up topics? What are you looking at?
Well, you know, it's actually, this will be a really fun sort of little mini tour that I'm doing now, because, you know, we've been so busy that I haven't been on the road since before the election. And, you know, I spent so much of my act sort of, I think, of the 2 years before sort of like charting the progress of this really important decision the country was making. And now that that's over, it'll be fun to sort of talk about that reality of when the second term starts and having to sort of settle into what's actually going to be happening.
Yeah. Well, you are an Obama supporter.
Yes.
Does that make
you... I supported him in his first term.
And then what?
And then I was like, well, okay, I'll just sit back on this one.
If John Kerry gets appointed to Secretary of State, do you start doing your John Kerry impersonation?
I was
again?
Told in no uncertain terms by Lorne Michaels not to expect a return to John Kerry.
Ah, our sustenance has arrived.
It's room service, John. Use a small word.
Is Lorne Michaels like the master puppet manipulator of Saturday Night Live? I was reading that Inside Saturday Night Live book.
Uh-huh.
You know, and Lorne Michaels is just, he seems like a genius, a comic and business genius of working with people.
He is he's one of those really, really smart people who can get a point across with a perfect economy of words. And that is the thing that I've been most impressed by, and hopefully the thing I've learned best from spending so much time working underneath him. He has incredible taste. That is his quality that I'm sort of most jealous of. He's the kind of guy that when we, you know, we'll go to Chicago and we'll watch improv shows to try to find new talent. And Lauren is the guy who can just sort of see somebody who maybe even has a rocky show the night we see it. And he's kind of like, that is the person who is going to be good at this show. And more often than not, he's right.
Hmm. Interesting. Anybody of late that you guys have brought on that you both were watching and said, oh, that's a guy we got to bring in, or a girl?
Well, we actually, you know, this has been a really, this was an exciting year because we did bring in three new people from a trip to Chicago, and they've all been working out great. You know, Tim Robinson and Cecily Strong and Adi Bryant. And, you know, just at the end of last year, this girl, Kate McKinnon, who's wonderful. And that is a really fun time to be working on the show, as much fun as it is when you sort of have this really solid veteran cast. The really exciting thing is to be here and watch really talented people sort of figure out how the show works and figure out how to be great at it.
What's the job of the head writer?
The job of the head writer is like, I feel like it's kind of like the ER doctor. You just have to do a lot of triage. You have to definitely let some people die. But hopefully you can staunch the bleeding and some things. A lot of times as head writer, you know, it's what are the gaps as we sort of hit Thursday, Friday. You know, do we have a cold open? Do we have a monologue? Do we have Weekend Update features? But more often than not, you know, I write sketches like everybody else. We have an incredibly talented writing staff. And, you know, there can be weeks where, as head writer, you sort of have very little to do because of how well everybody else has done their jobs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Who writes the Weekend Update stuff? Is that all you?
No. We have three incredible joke writers because we have sketch writers and we have the three joke writers for Weekend Update. It turns out they are incredibly different skill sets, and they are the three best I've ever seen. And so they and myself write a lot of the Weekend Update stuff.
What do you mean? Different, like somebody pays attention to politics, or is it about skill sets in terms of where a punchline comes in?
No, it's like the skill set of like people who write jokes that are sort of, you know, two-line jokes that are for me to say, and people who write full sketches, which are, you know, full production value and, you know, have sort of beginning, middles, and ends. Or, as some people would say about Saturday Night Live, have beginnings and middles. But the writing a perfectly structured joke, it turns out, is an incredibly, there are very few people who can do it at a very high level.
President Obama this past weekend addressed the Congressional Black Caucus and told them to stop complaining, stop grumbling, stop crying, and help him fix the economy and get reelected. Though I'm not sure if the mic drop was necessary.
You know, I was watching, I wish I could remember which episode it was, but it was a recent episode of SNL, and it was great from beginning till end.
Well, I mean, look, I'd love to tell you that we have different approaches to different weeks, but, you know, we obviously always want the show to be strong from beginning to end. But the other thing is, you know, we do want the show, by design, the show is uneven in that, you know, there isn't like, you know, it's not like a sitcom or even an hour-long drama where your writer's room is about making sure it all fits together with the rest of the shows. We want to have it be, you know, this piece is this writer's voice. And when we take that to the rewrite table, we try to make it better, but we don't try to change the voice. We don't try to take that person's DNA out of the piece. I've always sort of contended that the best SNL episode is sort of three sketches you love and one sketch you hate. The thought process being that, like, hopefully that one you hate is one of the ones that somebody else loves. But there is a sense here that you're trying to have a lot of different kinds of comedy. You want to do some strange things. You want to do some sort of, you know, more, you know, broad pieces for people. But, you know, we also keep in mind that, you know, we have people who watch the show who are 12 years old, which is the age I was when I first started watching it. And, you know, we have people that, you know, like my parents who were there when the first episode premiered and are still watching it. So it's fun to know that you have like sort of that wide an audience, and it's fun. Obviously, you know, there are those episodes where I think we walk away feeling like we, you know, knocked it out from the beginning to the end and everything was really great. But, you know, we also accept that that's not, it's very hard to pull that off week in and week out.
Do you have a favorite part, a recent favorite Weekend Update bit, either that you thought was most scathing or just funniest?
Well, I mean, it's always such, I think I'm like sort of predisposed to love those moments where I get to sort of just be an audience member as well and play straight man to one of the many talented people to come out. Bobby Moynihan playing drunk uncle is just a thing that I delight in. Last year, I mean, I think maybe one of the most surreal moments of my life was being out at the Weekend Update desk when Andy Samberg was playing Nick Cage, and the actual Nick Cage was also playing Nick Cage.
Let's do our self-esteem exercises where we pay each other compliments.
All right, very well, I'll begin. Nick, I love your charisma.
Nick, I love your lion's heart.
Nick, I love your sense of humor. Dry and marbled like a quality beefsteak. No A1 sauce required for this jester. For the tangy flavor rises from within. Also, I love your scent. Musky and masculine. Like that of a silverback gorilla in a form-fitting leather jacket.
That's high praise.
That was a moment where I was like, this is really probably all downhill for me as far as the rest of my life goes.
I love Stefan and you and Bill Hader on the set together. There just seems like you guys seem way out on the edge of what's going to happen next.
Oh, it's the best. And, you know, a very, very talented, funny stand-up and writer, John Mulaney, writes those with Bill, and John will, between dress and air, insert a few jokes that Bill hasn't seen yet, nor have I heard Bill say them. So part of, I think, that on the edge is that sense that we know that there's going to be at least one or two things that are new to us on air, and that's not a thing that sort of happens on the show. You know, it's all about getting it into its best possible shape for air and no more surprises. But it's great to have a couple of surprises in that. And it's great, too, because when Stefan sort of rolls out on Weekend Update, he's so beloved now that there's almost like a gasp from the audience, which is very exciting to hear.
That was comedian Seth Meyers, Saturday Night Live head writer, anchor of Weekend Update. He's here in Seattle doing stand-up next Thursday, January 31st, 7:30 at the Paramount. You can also find him on Twitter. He tweets his comedy at SethMeyers21. We talked to Seth about Twitter. You can find that snippet of the interview and a conversation we had with him about covering the 2012 election on our Facebook page, weekday on KUOW. Okay, Nick Bond, state climatologist, make the weather funny.
Well, yeah, that's a tall order.
I'm
more kind of yawning at the weather today. Actually, a pretty decent day with maybe a few sprinkles, but temperatures in the mid to high 40s. I see some patches of blue out there. And the weekend, not so great, with rain developing on Saturday morning and then showers in the afternoon, tapering off in the evening. Temperatures lower to mid 40s, a little bit of snow in the mountains. Sunday, it's more than the morning looks a little better with just hit and miss showers, but then rain again moving in the afternoon, early evening, and the mountains getting some pretty good coverage of snow, but not really heavy amounts. You asked me to be funny.
You don't.
Weather gods are kind of playing with me there. A day or two ago, it looked like there was going to be a storm coming out of southeast Alaska that would drag down enough cold air to make it for some interesting weather around here, if you know what I mean. I think you do. But now
I do know what you mean. I'm glad that didn't work.
Yeah, now the models are emphatic about just clipping only the very northeast part of the state with the colder air, and so we get kind of ripped off once again here in the Seattle area. And for next week, it's just going to be kind of mostly cloudy with a little bit of light rain in the lowlands, snow in the mountains at times. And so, it's a little bit boring.
But you're saying, looking at the long-term models, and I know we have to understand that they are long-term, we might see February a bit drier than usual, but wet, cool and wet March and April.
Right. Yeah. What I've been looking at is the forecast out of this global climate model that's used for seasonal weather prediction. And in particular, I looked back in its December forecast for the month of January to see if it, you know, had the indication of the real kind of dry period we had. And the forecast from late December were indicating that pattern quite well. And so that model now is showing February to be a bit on the quiet side, but then maybe the other shoe will drop, or whatever the expression is. It looks like that March into April will be a lot livelier with stronger storms, heavier mountain snows. Our last 2 years have featured kind of a rather chilly and moist late winter, early spring, and so the model at least is indicating more of the same this year.
My least favorite model. All right, that sounds like a time to go to Hawaii.
There you go.
All right, Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate you talking to us again. Nick Bond joins us every Friday. He's the Washington State climatologist. He works for the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. We're going to review the news of the week coming up. Stick around. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
Just about an hour ago, President Obama announced Dennis McDonough as his new chief of staff. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Because of my unfortunate situation with Avery, I'm alone. And I know, of course, that you're not seeing anyone. Therefore, I've decided that you and I should become friends with benefits.
No, thank you, please.
The final episode.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.